Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Molly Ivins tick? The late Texas columnist who died in 2007 was as reviled by many conservatives as she was revered by many liberals for her fierce criticisms of the foibles of public officials, notably Governor and then President George W. Bush, to whom she famously referred as Shrub. Her folksy, funny style earned her hundreds of devoted friends and millions of loyal readers, but it also put her at odds with her editors during a stint at the New York Times, who were scandalized when she wandered the paper's venerated halls barefoot and were irritated by the colloquialisms that colored her writing. Even her most ardent followers might have been surprised to know that the hard-drinking, plain-spoken columnist who wrote about growing up in East Texas in fact spent her childhood as a bookworm in Houston's Tony River Oaks neighborhood, attending the city's most prestigious private school before earning degrees at Smith College and Columbia University. So how did Molly Ivins make herself into the renegade writer we remember? Bill Minutaglio is professor of journalism at the University of Texas. He chronicles her life in his new book, written with W. Michael Smith, called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. Bill, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Good to be with you.
What sort of person was Molly Ivins expected to become based on the time and place in which she came of age?
Sure. She was expected to basically live above the cloud line in that sort of real rarefied air world of Houston, Texas, and as you noted, in River Oaks, one of the best zip codes in America. She was expected to be a socialite, to marry well, to have children, and probably not really aspire to any particular career other than being a homemaker.
Ironically, her formative years seem to have been spent in very similar circumstances to George W. Bush's.
Yeah, that's always the anomaly, especially considering their divergent, you know, political interests and the way she came after him, as you aptly characterized. She called him a shrub all the time, and I'm sure he had some other, choice descriptions for her as well, as he was on the receiving end of her commentary. But yeah, they knew each other. They lived, down the block from each other, essentially, in River Oaks again. She had gone to St. John's, one of the finest private schools in that city, and by extension the state, and arguably the country. He had tried to get into St. John's, but had to, quote, settle for going to another private school there called Kincaid. That said, they met each other frequently in social circles at the River Oaks Country Club. Both of their parents were very heavily involved in the energy sector at a very high level. Molly's father at one point was the president of Tenneco, one of the largest oil conglomerates in the world. And so there was a big nexus there. They saw each other a lot. They weren't best friends, but they did know each other.
She did have a tough relationship with her dad. Folks called him General Jim. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, we were very, very, very careful in terms of trying to examine him right from the outset, because most folks, including Molly's siblings, told us that she is best understood through the prism of her father, and in that everything he stood for, she ran away from, that she grew up trying to be completely unlike him. So we really wanted to try to understand him. He was a very domineering man. He stood about 6'5" when he, entered a room. He really sort of filled up the room. And he had a military background. He had served in World War II and had seen some intense action in the Pacific Theater. And most folks said he brought that kind of military bearing to the family. It ran like clockwork. It was very, very formal. He was extremely conservative in his politics, an ardent capitalist, if you will. He was also a lawyer, so he knew how to argue very well. But to his great surprise, he found that his second child, Molly, was one of three. She was the middle child. She had an older sister and a younger brother. To his surprise, at a very young age, really starting around the age of 10 or 11, there was appeared to be another lawyer in training in the family, and that was Molly Ivins, who really took him to task on just about everything under the sun, from politics to the role of, quote, big oil in America. It's almost hard to imagine, but at a very, very young age, a preteen age, she was questioning authority in her household.
What's fascinating about that, and even she credited that relationship with the strength that she developed, because she learned early on not only how to stand up to power, but she learned that she liked it.
Yeah, she sure did. Molly is a, you know, I think, you know, for a lot of readers and folks who just know her almost by her first name, you know, Molly, it's interesting when you look at the many thousands of letters that she received over her life from readers. They're often addressed, "Dear Molly," and there's this presumption of familiarity. In fact, folks then say in the second sentence, or the first sentence, really, after they write, "Dear Molly," they say, "Please forgive me. I feel like I know you." So she has this very you know, public persona, this 1,000-watt smile that some folks might remember from the covers of her national bestsellers, and certainly from her newspaper column, which appeared in close to 400 papers. But she had very private compartments that she didn't reveal, and that very few, even very few of her very most close friends were unaware of. And a lot of that circled around her relationship with her dad and her sense that he was so domineering and so inhibiting in terms of her intellectual growth that it only spurred her to want to read more and learn more and to presume that there was a bigger and more different world outside this very restrictive household she grew up in.
And, of course, this happened much later in her life, but the day that she learned of his death reads like the scene in a novel.
Yeah, it was really incredibly dramatic. What we tried to do in our book was to rely on Molly's words, and by that I mean not relying on the columns so much that she had written, because those are evident and they're available, and frankly, a lot of people you know, had seen them in these bestsellers that she wrote that were compilations of her work. What we rather tried to do was go into her archives, which were publicly available in Austin, at the Center for American History, affiliated with the University of Texas. We went in there and found that Molly had donated literally thousands and thousands of documents from her life, including many, many deeply personal letters, you know, grade school report cards, pay stubs, unpaid parking tickets, you know, all kinds of diary entries. And what we began to see in those archives was Molly's sort of deliberate progression into dealing with her father. And it was a lifelong battle. It lasted for decades. And yes, as you said, it culminated in a moment in the late 90s when Molly received word that her father, the man that she had sort of railed against and had this long sort of tortured relationship with, had frankly committed suicide. And it happened at a moment, literally at the exact moment as when Molly was at her home here in Austin, beginning to write a column about her father and her relationship with her father. And the column was really almost intended finally to introduce some sort of a sense of peace. It was as if she was extending an olive branch to him and doing it the way that she knew best, by writing something, by writing a column, in fact. And as she was in midstream writing this column about her dad and trying to establish some relationship with him once more, she received a phone call that he had committed suicide. And Molly, in quite dramatic fashion, continued to do the only thing that she really knew to do, which was to put down the phone after hearing that horrible news and continue to write her column. And she actually finished it. Obviously, the column took quite a different turn, but it was a startling act, divorced from how you feel about Molly politically, a startling act of courage and a truly dramatic narrative in her life.
She was always a writer and always a reader, and that sort of explains how she came to call herself Molly over time. Will you tell us that?
Yeah, exactly. She was actually at birth was named Mary. And those you know, close friends of her knew that, and some family members, of course, knew that. What happened was that Molly loved to read, as you said, and would literally burrow up in her room. She had an attic room above the garage, and that was her warren. That was her hideaway, her fort, if you will. And she would go in there and surround herself with books, and she was an extremely voracious reader. She really just loved to sort of feed her head with books and books and books. She would read anything from romances to westerns to Greek tragedies to works written in the French language, which she had begun to master as a teenager. Her brother and her father both began to refer to her as the mole, M-O-L-E, the mole who was kind of burrowing in her room, surrounded by her books, and mold kind of transmogrified into Molly over time, and that's in some way how she became Molly Ivins as opposed to Mary Ivins.
She never married, but based on your account, it sounds very much like she would have had her boyfriend not been killed in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, an incredibly, I'm biased in saying this, but I thought an incredibly dramatic story as well, and one that I knew was so compartmentalized in Molly's life that she simply hadn't shared it with very many people. I ran into, a few weeks ago, just as the book was coming out, I ran into one of Molly's oldest friends. I would put her on the short list of Molly's best friends, maybe one of her two or three best friends in life, somebody who had known her intimately very, very well for you know, close to 40 years. And she told me I had no idea about this relationship that Molly had had with this man. Molly was engaged to be married while in college to a rather mercurial and interesting guy who was a student at Yale, whose father had been a high-ranking assistant secretary of state in the Eisenhower administration, extremely conservative family. In fact, the father of this young man whom she was going to be married to was, in effect, a CIA operative who spent a lot of time in Central America, basically doing the CIA's bidding. And so Molly, when you weigh that against Molly's politics, of course, that just seems completely you know, counterintuitive. But here she was being married or planning to get married way above the cloud line again, well in those gilded circles. So this was a young man who was living in Greenwich, Connecticut, which quite coincidentally is where the Bush family had a lot of roots. So she was going to marry into this very conservative, very Republican, very wealthy family. This young man whom she called the love of her life died, yes, in a wickedly violent motorcycle accident just outside the grounds, by the way, of the Weyerhaeuser family estate in the state of Washington. And the Weyerhaeuser family is perhaps the greatest lumber magnate family in American history. So it gives you an indication of the kinds of folks Molly was hanging out with at that time. I contend in our book that this young man had to die, in a sense, for Molly to become Molly Ivins. He represented, I think, the last hope that her own parents had that she would marry into those gilded circles, that she would become a socialite. And when he passed away, well, she never married again. She had various relationships with other men in her life, but none like this young man. And he represented in some way, or rather his death represented almost a clean but very awful and wicked break with her past and the expectations that her parents had been pressing on her.
So essentially at that point, it was all about her career. She wasn't interested in marrying again.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. She threw herself into her work. She decided that, you know, I want to be a writer. She thought of herself first as a writer, and that she was very self-effacing. She said, I don't know that I could write the great American novel, and maybe I'll try my hand at journalism. And she sure did.
Bill Minutaglio is my guest. He's professor of journalism at the University of Texas. We're talking today about his new book, Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of journalism at the University of Texas, Bill Minutaglio. His new book is called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bill, I want to talk about how Molly's sense of herself as a Texan evolved over time, because there were points early in her life when, in fact, she tried to avoid drawing attention to that.
Yeah, she sure did. And, you know, Molly liked to have fun. I think that's probably stating the obvious. She had a great ability to do something that you know, just very few people can do, which is to write funny, and especially to write about the, you know, the bloviating Senator Foghorn Leghorns of life in a funny way. It's just difficult to render that probably in the right light and to do it funny. So she, at a very early age, she was developing that sense and developing a sense, I think, of wanting to please people and to draw them in by telling funny stories. And I think she learned early on, maybe by growing up in a home with a lawyer, that there was a great utility to telling stories, and that you could probably convey a message through really wonderful storytelling. And, yeah, a little bit of humor. You put a little, you know, honey on the peas, and people will get that kind of, they'll get the nutrition of the peas, but it'll seem palatable. Molly knew the quality or the benefit of telling a good story with a little bit of humor on it. And early on, she would tell people, especially after she left home and went to Smith College, her mom had gone to Smith and her grandmother had gone to Smith, so she was following those lines of expectations like we had talked about earlier. And at Smith, it happened to coincide with a time period when the nation's attention was moving toward Texas, in you know, for both bad and for both good and bad reasons. People were trying to figure out who this fellow Lyndon Baines Johnson was, and then especially as after the Kennedy assassination, people were trying to figure out what Texas was all about. There was a sort of a thirst for knowledge, and so people were turning to Molly Ivins. She was from Texas, and she learned very quickly in college that people were fascinated, and in fact almost couldn't believe some of the things that she was telling them. And she, early on, again in college, began developing this sort of storytelling capability, and frankly leaning perhaps a little bit on the stereotypes that she envisioned coming out of Texas. So as an example, she would talk about radio preachers, people that would you know, preach over the radio in the sort of histrionic way, and she would kind of replicate their programs, and you know, people from the Northeast whom she was going to school with were mesmerized by this thing. It seemed like she was describing some exotic foreign land. And I think Molly learned early on that it was probably going to be fun and funnier to maybe exaggerate, not toward a mean-spirited end, but just for storytelling purposes, to kind of have fun with the image of Texas and to play it up a little bit, and you know, expand upon things here and there a bit. And that is where it took root, and she began realizing the utility of that over time. She would tell you, by the way, especially when she began in earnest covering Texas politics, that you couldn't make this stuff up. It was really a waste of time to exaggerate. It was low-hanging fruit. It was just there for the picking, and she didn't need to do any exaggerating at all. All she needed to do was go out with her reporter's notebook and capture all these characters and rascals and, you know, over-the-top figures and let them do all the describing themselves. But she did have an acute sense of herself, and what I would say Molly did so well that's very difficult for journalists to do is to really be in the moment with somebody or something. So she could be in far west Texas in a small town in the panhandle and be really in the moment, really engaged, really talking the talk with folks there, because she was a student of Texas and she authentically loved it. At the same time, she had an ability to kind of hover above it, and this is why she was a very good journalist. She could be in the moment, but sort of pull back and offer a sort of a panoramic look at either the individual she was writing about or talking to, or the circumstances they were involved in. So you got this microscopic kind of inquiry in her part and this dedication to intimate details, but then as well she had the ability to kind of step back and give it a little bit of sweep and scope. And that's why her work in many ways, though often about Texas, was really, you know, enjoyed by people around the state. They felt that they were getting sort of a two-for-one special. They were getting a yarn, a story, some humor, and it might be specific, again, to a locale or an issue in Texas, but there were these bigger lessons that Molly was trying to draw down, and she did that very consciously, very, very, very deliberately, and she did it, I think, very, very well.
One of the things, Bill, that seems to have opened a lot of doors for her and helped her to maintain a lot of good sources was also a major Achilles heel for her, and that was her drinking.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, she struggled with it at various times in her life, and sometimes she was okay, and sometimes she was not okay.
Yeah, absolutely. One of her very, very good friends told me that Molly's lover was alcohol, and that was why she didn't ever get married, that she was devoted to alcohol. And what we try to do is an extremely sensitive topic, and it's a really eternal conundrum that sounds sanctimonious for me to describe, you know, my process this way. But it was very difficult to try to introduce that element into the book because it informed her life, but not to, frankly, overdo it. And what we decided to do when writing about it was to rely on Molly's own words. Again, she was an unbelievable pack rat, and she kept all of these documents and as well kept diaries. And some of them were informal. They would just be notes jotted down on scraps of papers. Some of them were a little more formal in terms of being put in notebooks. And then while she was alive, began donating all of this material to a public archive in Texas, albeit with the restriction that a lot of it only be viewed and unsealed after her passing. So we were able to look at a lot of this material, and what you do see in Molly's own words, and which again is what we hopefully faithfully tried to introduce into the book, were these descriptions of a process that began, frankly, probably in the late 1960s, but that continued really up through probably about 2005, where she was really going through a roller coaster ride with alcohol, and it led to some very awful, some very scary, some very dangerous moments in her life, moments where she could have died, moments where she put other people in great danger, moments where she frankly threw her career into great, great difficulty and could have really, you know, derailed everything and not become the famous Molly Ivins that we all knew. She had a profound relationship with alcohol, and it haunted her for most of her working life, and she was very, very, very aware of it, you know, on a almost comical level in some way. People were telling us that when she showed up for her job interview in Texas for her first real journalism job in Texas, which was to be the editor or co-editor of the Texas Observer, she showed up toting a six-pack of beer. On one level, that tells you how Molly's very carefree and pretty, you know, independent-minded, which she was. Other folks have said, you know, that was might have been, you know, on a serious level, a cautionary note that you know, maybe she would be wedded a little too much to alcohol through life. And what happened in a nutshell, and forgive me for giving you such a long answer to such a good question. As a matter of process, Molly decided that in order to truly become a good journalist in Austin, Texas, and to really understand the crazy, over-the-top, almost demonic machinations of what was going on in the state house in Texas, she had to drink and drink and drink and drink some more, because that's what the powerful state lawmakers were doing. And the real business of government, which I think is still true today, takes place outside the confines of you know, the state house, strictly speaking. It's in the hallways, it's in the after-hours clubs, it's in the nightclubs, it's at the wet bars and the private offices of the state lawmakers. Molly realized that's where the stories really were. That's really where power was being concocted. And she began hanging out there. She literally had an ability, according to most of her friends, to drink every single one of those men. Molly was often, throughout her life, the only woman in the room. she began to drink these men under the table, and boy, were they surprised the next day to learn that she not only drank them under the table, she took really darn good notes on everything they were saying, and it was in the next day's paper. And they were gobsmacked. They were just knocked out. How did that happen? She had an iron constitution. Most people say years and years of that, scooping everybody, getting stories, and nobody had heard it. It caught up to her because she was trying to keep pace, with a lot of that lifestyle.
Bill Minutaglio is my guest. The new book is called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. Let's go on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 to Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. I wanted to ask a question. Let me get out of the office here. It's a little bit noisy. I was curious if the professor had written anything or come across anything about Molly's relationship with a man who she dedicated one of her books to, I think her first book, a guy named Bob Moore.
Sure.
And, well, you had. You did know some things about her relationship with Bob, their friendship.
Sure, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned him. And something tells me that you might know about him or even know more about him than I do. But yeah, that's a great question. He was an extraordinarily influential person in Molly's evolution. He was one of her teachers at St. John's, again, the private school in Houston, in River Oaks. And you're absolutely right. She dedicated one of her works to him, and that's for a good reason. She felt that he was really the first, I would say, adult in her life to introduce her to a way of thinking that stood in direct contrast to her father's way of thinking. He was rather progressive, I would say, in his politics, and he was an expansively thinking man. He loved to read poetry and could quote Robert Frost, and he could quote Ernest Hemingway. He happened to be politically a supporter of the candidacy of John F. Kennedy, and he believed in sort of extracurricular work outside the confines of the classroom. He believed in community participation, in voting drives, in food drives, and he really, Molly credits him enormously with opening her up in to a sense of being engaged in a democracy. And also thinking about the world holistically, and by that I mean that he was a great adherent of travel and would lead students on trips around the world even. And so I think he really was fundamental in helping to shape Molly Ivins, and she was very aware of it, aside from his encouraging her just to put pencil to paper. The other thing he was... by standards, I think, of other folks she hung out with and other educators, he was kind of not a rascal, but almost a raconteur. She felt comfortable enough around him to even smoke a cigarette. And, you can imagine, just as a young woman back then at that age, that was a pretty radical development. But he opened her eyes to other possibilities and encouraged her. He encouraged her to write. Molly, in school, by the way, she called herself... a Clydesdale among thoroughbreds. And by that she meant at the age of 12, she was already 6 feet tall. She was becoming myopic. She wore glasses. And when her friends were going to the prom and even to debutante balls, Molly felt somewhat excluded. She wasn't enormously confident in her own skin. And she says that Bob Moore helped her through that. He reinforced the thought that she had a powerful intellect and that she could read and write very well. And she always looked back to him as a fundamental, influence on her life.
There's such a fascinating dichotomy in this book, Bill, between Molly's extraordinary confidence and her ability to just say exactly what was on her mind, and also this insecurity. And I wonder if you also saw that manifested, and I know you knew her personally as well, but in the fact that she essentially couldn't say no to anybody who asked her for anything and went out of her way almost to a fault in terms of just generosity.
It almost seemed obsessive. I worried, along with my co-author, whether we were appearing sycophantic in some way. And, there were so many instances of generosity, and I remember talking with my editor about it. she said, gee, this almost seems like an enumerated list of her acts of generosity. And I said, I think we need to have some of them in there just to illustrate it. Rather than just saying she was generous, I think we need to show those actual moments where she literally gave away money, gave away clothing, let people crash at her house, gave them all of her frequent flyer miles. It kept going after she died. She had indicated that she wanted people to come by and take objects from her house, people who didn't even really know her that well, cooking utensils, everything. There's this sort of sense of Molly's legacy being spread everywhere. I wondered what that was about, what some people told us, you know, armchair psychologist friends of hers, if you will, said that, you know, Molly had a surrogate family, her own family, you know, she had difficulties with her, both her mother and father, and even at times with her siblings, whom she dearly loved. But it was at times a, you know, family that was a little distant, members were distant from each other, and that Molly really wanted this other family of really, truly like-minded individuals, people who were attuned to her politically, of course, and hopefully were as unfiltered as she was, and frankly as funny as she was, who liked to tell jokes, who liked to stay up really late and knock you know, people off their high horses, people in power, that is. And so she developed this other, almost, again, her second family. And she made sure that those members were taken care of. She, if people were stumbling in life, she dusted them off, gave them jobs, gave them work, helped them get mortgages, helped them with letters of recommendation. She really went out of her way. And I think, you know, at one level I thought, gee, that in and of itself should just be taken at face value. Why try to analyze, you know, the root of it? But to the extent that we did, I think it stems from the sense that she wanted to have this big, all-inclusive family of friends out there.
Bill Minutaglio is my guest. He's professor of journalism at the University of Texas. His new book, written with W. Michael Smith, is called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is University of Texas journalism professor Bill Minutaglio. His new book is called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Chris, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm so glad that you're doing this show today, because Molly was such a great delight, and such a one-of-a-kind person, and it's just a thrill to hear these wonderful stories about her. I was very lucky to have known Molly personally, and in fact, I have in my archives a photograph of John Henry Falk and Molly and I in the lobby of the old New Arts Theater here in Dallas after John Henry and I did a fundraiser for a school here in Dallas once. So I would like to tell you about the time that I called Molly. I had worn myself out on behalf of some progressive cause and was burned out, and called her and just said, Molly, you know, how is it you never seem to lose your energy? But you always seem to have another great story, another laugh. And she said, David, remember when you cover the Texas legislature, there's always something else to be angry about. There's always something else to laugh about. And that was how she kept her spirits up, I think. And I just thought that was some of the best advice I ever got.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, David.
You bet.
That's a great story. And I might add, you know, Molly, in her very last writings, urged, literally in her last column, which she dictated, you know, from her deathbed in January of 2000, she basically urged her readers to continue to render the ridiculous in a ridiculous fashion. In other words, have fun writing about those ridiculous folks that you know, regrettably, we seem to vote into office who are conspiring to do something to us rather than something for us. So she realized in speeches that she gave throughout her life, she always emphasized, especially to young journalists, you need to have fun, just to have fun and have fun, and don't let yourself get wearied by cynicism and circumstances. That it's always better to at least try to approach even awful circumstances in some way with a sense of optimism and yes, even humor.
You have a great story in the book about her literally running into then Governor Bush at the Texas Book Festival, and they both sort of laughed and embraced each other. Was it personal to her? Did she expect people to be angry with her when she wrote things about them that they didn't like?
I think she was inured to it by that time. On a serious note, I mean, there are some very scary, you know, moments in her life that again, no one would really know about unless she had known, you know, had worked for Molly perhaps, or had seen her archives here in Austin. She received many death threats, and some, you know, mysterious powders sent her in the mail, and things that the FBI had to check into, and so on. So on a very serious note, she had built up a pretty thick skin over time. There's some evidence early on that Molly used to take a lot of that very personally. That obviously anybody would, but that she was, you know, personally very, very worried and concerned. But then over time, I think she became inured to it and frankly, even more courageous to just sort of brush it off. But yeah, she was very comfortable in her skin. She just didn't look back. I think as a metaphor, perhaps, or one way to look at it, there are three moments in my book where she just hauls back and knocks a guy to the ground. I mean, physically, literally, I have no other way of saying it. One of them happens to be Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, who in many ways, in my estimation, from having written a book about George W. Bush, was perhaps the most pivotal figure, political figure, in George W. Bush's pre-presidential life. He was the guy that paved the way for Bush to become president. And there's one scene in the book where Molly just basically, you know, knocks the guy to the ground. He kind of deserved it, I might add, based on everything. And of course, when he got knocked to the ground by Molly Ivins, he was preventing her from leaving a bar in Austin where she was up doing her thing, which was basically downloading information from unsuspecting powerful politicians. He decided he wasn't going to let her go home. She just shoved him to the ground, literally walked right over him, and as she strode away, you know, Bob Bullock, arguably the most powerful political figure in Texas, just said, "My God, you know, Molly Ivins, what a woman!" and so he was impressed. And there's a moment up in Dallas where she turns around and basically cold cocks a guy whom she thought had inappropriately touched her on a public street. It turned out she actually hit the wrong guy, but guess what? He later on told folks it happened to be a fellow journalist. He later on proudly said Molly Ivins was the greatest journalist he had ever met, and this is a guy that who had gotten his teeth knocked out by Molly. And there are some other moments in her life. She was very combative in those moments when she felt authentically set upon and people weren't allowing her to do her thing, to say what she wanted to say or to behave the way that she wanted to behave. So she took no prisoners.
Did she think of herself as a role model?
She felt that she was a role model for certain things. I don't think she would say that her life, in essence, was a role model that anybody should replicate. Her way of doing things and staying out that late and hanging out with these characters so often. I think she felt that she was a role model for young women who wanted to get into journalism. She grew up in a time period where women were, frankly and obviously regrettably, exiled to the, quote, women's pages at various publications, and they weren't, quote, expected or allowed to do hard news stories, let alone the political commentary with an edge. So I think she always felt, as a student of her own history and a student of journalism and even the role of women in the media, that she was a role model in that regard. I think, you know, broadly speaking, Molly wrote one time when she was a young woman on a piece of paper, "I want to become famous before I turn 25, and if I don't, I'll commit suicide." It's a rather, you know, dramatic moment, of course. I maintain in talking with her family that really what she meant is that she wanted to be known and perhaps be a role model for folks who were making a difference. I don't think she wanted to be a celebrity, especially in the way we define a celebrity prevalently today, a pop culture figure. I think she wanted to be known for making a difference.
Late in her career, she was accused of plagiarism, and that was a really devastating blow to her. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. She was accused, essentially, by a writer, someone who, broadly speaking, would be called a humorist, a Southern humorist essayist named Florence King, who had contended, alleged that Molly had not correctly attributed some of her work to Ms. King, and the upshot was that Molly felt that she had attributed the material to this other writer, but then essentially said, well, perhaps I didn't attribute enough to you, that I need to do a more extensive litany of attributions. So there was some disagreement in some way, but Molly did come forward, and her argument was, look, I attributed to you, and I didn't attribute every, word that you wanted me to attribute to you. So it was a little bit of a he said, she said. But Molly kind of owned up to it in some way, and she said she had said one time when some of her friends were around, I know this from talking to someone who was in the room with her, she said, well, there goes my Pulitzer. And here's Molly Ivins in a nutshell. She wrote a letter to the other writer and apologized and explained in sort of the fashion I did that she felt that she had certainly attributed the material to this woman, but perhaps could have done a longer attribution. But then at the end, in very colorful language, Molly essentially assails the woman and says, I'm sorry this all happened, but by the way, you're not such a pleasant person, are you? And she used far more colorful language than I just used. And I took that as emblematic of Molly's sort of combative, almost pugilistic nature, that she felt, that even if she would apologize to someone, and even when she perhaps felt that she didn't need to, that she would also sort of thumb her nose at the same time. And, she again went out, swinging.
And she signed the letter, Molly Ivins, comma, plagiarist.
Yes, yeah, she was really, and this says a lot about Molly, too. At her very large memorial service here in Austin, it was extraordinarily well attended. It was almost like a state funeral, and this being, her adopted hometown and really sort of Molly Central here in Austin, some bits of her work were read at the memorial service, and someone who had worked for Molly was listening to someone reading some of Molly's work at Molly's memorial service, and the person who was listening almost passed out, because what he was hearing someone read was, in fact, the work that Molly had been accused of plagiarizing. And he was going, oh, my God, this is just awful. But then he realized that this was Molly's last joke, that Molly had picked this selection and actually had asked that it be read, and that it was sort of her final, forgive me for saying this, almost her raised middle finger to the whole notion of people taking a lot of this stuff almost too seriously and themselves too seriously. So even after passing away, Molly was still laughing and having a little bit of fun.
She did not like Dallas.
Well, she would tell you she liked the people, but maybe didn't like the stereotype that she had envisioned or had begun to endorse in Dallas. And Molly's like the world's oldest teenager. She was just going to continue to sort of find the little bruise on your arm and keep poking at it and then poking at it until it was sort of funny but not. And she objectified the holy heck out of Dallas in some ways and seized upon some stereotypes which were maybe easy for her to reach for. You have to remember when she was in Dallas, it was just at the late 1970s and building up to the big Republican National Convention that was coming in 1984 and with Ronald Reagan and the elder George Bush as his vice president. And she felt that the city had really, you know, gravitated toward an almost on bended knee, status or approach as it related to the visiting, you know, Republican dignitaries, and that she could have a little fun with it. She did. She got in a little bit of trouble. I mean, famously or infamously, perhaps, I don't know. She wrote about a Texas lawmaker from that region. The words, if this politician's IQ drops any lower, we're going to have to start watering him twice a day. and she was beginning to write things like that. And, she said as well, or wrote, if you put Ronald Reagan's brain in a bee, the bumblebee will start flying backwards. So she was starting to write things that, about folks and people who are coming to town and that weren't all that endorsing and pleasant. And there was a sense among some editors, she worked at the old Dallas Times Herald, that she was starting to mess around with the franchise a little bit, the franchise being the city of Dallas. She was a columnist in the city of Dallas, and she was making fun of both the city and some of the people who were coming there. A little discrepancy about how it all happened, but she was relocated to Austin, Texas, still working for the Dallas newspaper, but sent to work in Austin, where, of course, she was very happy to be.
Bill, we have about a minute left. I wonder if you personally have a favorite Molly story.
I love the fact that, I hope these don't all seem so violent, but I love the story that we discovered about Molly being at a camp out in the hill country of Texas. She loved going camping with Ann Richards and Bob Bullock and John Henry Falk, who was a great figure in Texas letters and Texas history himself. She's hanging out with really famous people back in the 70s and 80s. And they used to love to go out in these camp outs. Willie Nelson would show up and so on, and a lot of like-minded individuals. Molly kind of went over to where Ann Richards and some of her friends were at this campfire and asked if anybody there knew about the particular man who was at this camp out, whom she said was really bothering her. They said, oh, he's kind of harmless. And she said, he seems to be drunk all the time, and he keeps bothering him. He's almost stalking me. And they said to her, no, don't worry about him. He's really a harmless guy. And Molly just turned to them and said, well, he's harmless now, because I just socked him so hard that he passed out face down in a cactus patch. And I don't know, it might not be an overtly political story, but I think, metaphorically, it tells you a lot about Molly. She often was the only woman in the room. She was often assailed, and she was very, very tough-minded and willing to stand her ground, and then, frankly, to tell a story about it with a neat beginning, middle, and an end.
Bill Minutaglio's new book is called Molly Ivins, A Rebel Life. Bill, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.